reflect, I listen, I acknowledge, and I affirm. I like to empower people. I like to see people empowered and you know, from our interactions, I like to see them benefit from that. So just leaving your people in a better place than you found them.
Welcome back to Work is Third. I'm your host, Dawn Hunter, and I'm so glad you're here. My guest today is Chris Tallbear, a Southern Cheyenne chief, tribal public health advisor, and community leader whose work bridges traditional knowledge and Western institutions. In this episode, we talk about what healing looks like across generations and what it means to carry tradition forward in the 21st century. This is a conversation about community, ceremony, and the responsibility of leadership, not just as a role, but as a way of life. Let's listen in. Hello, Chris, and welcome to Work is Third.
Hi, Dawn. It's good to see you this day.
I'm really glad that you're here. And so listeners know, we know each other because we both are public health professionals, and I've worked for a long time with the organization that you work for. But we also recently reconnected because of your work on the Sand Creek Massacre Memorial, and I want to get into that today. But before we do, I'm hoping you can kick us off by sharing a word to describe how you're doing today.
A word in my language, I would start out and say na pivamota. I feel good. I feel good today. So,
yeah. Na pivamota.
Na pivamota. Na is I. Pivamota is I feel good.
I feel good today. I like that.
Na pivamota.
What is making you feel good today?
Being home, feeling like I got a lot accomplished over this past weekend. It was a tough weekend. Went up to Colorado and spent a day, a morning at Sand Creek Massacre site. And then we jumped in a car and drove up to Denver, where we had a candlelight vigil at the downtown Denver Public Library to commemorate Sand Creek Massacre. It was November 29th, 1864, when that tragedy occurred. Myself being a descendant on both sides of my family, a direct descendant from people that survived the Sand Creek Massacre, it was a very real experience to go through.
I'm glad that you started there, because that's actually what we reconnected over recently. You had a really great article recently in the Colorado Sun, correct?
Correct.
Yeah, yes. You also are a tribal public health advisor. And one of the reasons I reached out to you is because a theme that comes up often on this podcast is community. And so we were talking about the ways in which we talked about a lot of things. We talked about the lessons that are passed down across generations. We talked about the importance of remembering our history and honoring our history. Tell me a little bit more about how you, because you are one of the leads on the memorial work, correct?
Correct. Correct. Yes. There are three of us that represent, you know, the tribes that were present at Sand Creek were the North. You know, back then, 1864, we didn't have IRA governments. We didn't have these tribal governments. So the Cheyenne and the Arapaho people were there. There was one Arapaho chief and I think about 13 or 14 Cheyenne chiefs there at Sand Creek. They were ordered to move to the Sand Creek area by, you know, the U.S. Army, and they were promised that they would be safe in that area. Two assurances, and as early as September of 1864, they were told, you know, if you're in this area, if you fly this American flag and this white flag of peace, you'll be protected. So this was Black Kettle's camp, and he did. He had that up, but, you know, kind of what's going on in this country at the moment, there's a lot of fear about people who don't look like us. And back in 1864, Colorado was still a territory, and they had an Indian problem. So they were using Governor Evans at the time of the territory had asked Colonel Shevington to get rid of the Indian problem and gave him permission. So on the morning of 1864, they came in and attacked our camp. You know, there was a lot of women and children there because it was a chief's camp. And it was our chief's duty to take care of our women and children, our orphans. So that was why there were a large number of them there. And the soldiers came in and just killed everybody. Not everybody, slaughtered about around 200 of them. And, you know, it's just, it's horrific to think about how these people that, you know, profess to be of a certain faith, but yet can go in and do that to another human being. And that killing had went on through the day and into the next day, into November 30th. And the soldiers had actually taken body parts as war trophies and carried them all the way to Denver, about maybe by car, it's about a 2.5-3 hour drive. By horse, it would be, you know, 180 miles or so to Denver. But they paraded those body parts through downtown Denver and, you know, put them on display there in downtown. And you know, those were people. It was just hard to imagine because it was cold, snow back then. The day that we were there this past weekend, they had 40-mile-an-hour winds, and the winds, the temperatures were in the mid-20s, but the wind chill had to be below zero. And if you can imagine, you know, your Cheyenne people being out there with no jackets, sometimes, you know, being woken up and having to run across that ground barefooted through the snow, you know, that was tough. I couldn't imagine. You know, I've heard stories. My mom's told me, you know, told some stories about Sand Creek and our relatives, but I never really fathomed until, you know, I started being involved in this project. So, but we've got several projects that are going on. One is the Sand Creek Memorial. It's a sculpture that is being sited there in front of the Colorado State Capitol. There was a Confederate statue that was there up until the 2000s, until it was toppled and removed. And up until that time, Colorado had talked about it being a victory, a battle, and it was not a battle. It was a massacre. So, you know, the truth needs to be out there. And we worked with the state. We had a lot of great support. This timeline kind of predates my involvement, but they had some really great support at the national level to get that Sand Creek site declared a national monument through the National Park Service, a historic site. Gosh, the senator from Colorado, I cannot think of his name off the top of my head. He was a Northern Cheyenne, an honorary member of the Northern Cheyenne, but he was a senator. Senator Ben Nighthorse Campbell was his name, and he was instrumental in getting this legislation through Congress to get it designated as a historic site. So that was one victory, and we had on our side many chiefs, many ceremonial and traditional people that had originally picked up, started this movement. And, you know, sadly, many of them are gone. And, you know, I didn't have direct contact with them. So I'm being educated on where things are, kind of the historic part of it, by a man named Otto Braided Hair, who's a Northern Cheyenne. And he's been involved. He picked up where his older brother Steve had left off. Steve walked on, went, you know, he passed away some years back, but Otto still carries that same passion to see this project through and ensure that the truth is being told in an accurate way and from our perspective through oral history. So we have the Sand Creek Massacre monument that's being sited in front of the Colorado State Capitol. The artist is named Gerald Shippen, who's putting it together now. There are three figures, Black Kettle, Left Hand, and a woman figure. We are naming Medicine Woman, who is Black Kettle's wife, but she's holding a baby. And it's to, you know, represent the resiliency that our people are still here, despite, you know, the many attempts to eradicate us, remove us, commit genocide. We're still here. So a lot of great people at the state level. There was a joint resolution passed by the Colorado legislature to support the monument being sited there in front of the Capitol. So that was good. We did go. I was involved with that ceremony, that commemoration. And we've just had really great support through the Colorado History Center, History Colorado, and the National Park Service, the state of Colorado and other foundations that have been very supportive. PAC Sapien is one of them. But there's other projects that come out of that as well. We do have a spiritual healing run annually. We moved that to October because if we were to have that in December or November, there is snow up there on the ground in Denver in November. So right. A lot of our older elders, you know, young people like to participate. So that was moved up into October to allow more people to participate. The northern states like Montana, they've got to contend with snow on the roads. So, you know, just to be more accommodating with the weather, it's moved to October.
Yeah. So I want to pause for a second. And for listeners who may not be aware about tribal structure in the U.S. I grew up in New Mexico, where there are 23 federally recognized tribes, pueblos, and nations. You are in Oklahoma. And maybe you could share a little bit with listeners about where you live and the Cheyenne, who I think are predominantly across Oklahoma, but it sounds like parts of Colorado as well.
Yeah. Colorado is one of the 1851 Fort Laramie Treaty. Gave us part, you know, up to the foothills of Colorado on the eastern side, and as far north as the Platte River, all the way north to the Arkansas River. Further north up, there was a big swath that included parts of Wyoming, Colorado, western Nebraska, and Kansas. So pretty big area that was designated for Cheyenne and Arapaho tribes. The federal government tried to start putting us together, but those were our treaty lands, you might say. The 1861 Fort Wise Treaty diminished that land that was designated for us, for Cheyenne people, and it gave us this little tiny piece that included Sand Creek. They tried to confine us to that area. IRA government, 1934, the Cheyenne and Arapaho Reservation government was established. Our reservation was developed by executive order, I think around, I want to say 1874, and it covered most of western Oklahoma. It was part of the original Cherokee land strip that was when the Cherokees were removed here back in 1830s. They started breaking up Indian country and assigning pieces of it to tribes. So our tribe, the Cheyenne and Arapaho tribes, received the western, northwestern quadrant of Oklahoma quite a bit. And we were encouraged to settle, take allotments, and adopt a sedentary agricultural lifestyle. Yeah. So myself, I live in Norman, Oklahoma. I've lived here for about 15 or 20 years with my wife. I'm a product of the University of Oklahoma. I've got a couple of degrees from there. I've got a bachelor's in Native American studies. I've got a master's in legal studies in energy and natural resources. And then I was working on a master's in sociocultural anthropology from the University of Oklahoma. And all of those are relevant to the work that we do, that I do in public health, that you do in public health, you know, the study of cultures and the law, the policy. So I felt like this was very relevant, taking a step outside of the tribal realm and working with NNPHI as their tribal public health advisor. It's opened my eyes up to kind of the broader landscape, public health, and how tribal public health fits into that. So it's quite a structure.
It is. You know, there's so many threads that I want to make sure that we follow up on. One of which is I try to be very careful, and I still probably don't say it in the right way, to not say, for example, the Cheyenne live in Oklahoma, because the Cheyenne are a sovereign nation. And so I wonder if you could share just your perspective for listeners of what is tribal sovereignty?
You know, it's the ability to for self-determination, to decide what's best for yourselves and your people that you serve, giving them that freedom of choice to decide, you know, whether it's their health, their well-being, the right to conduct your own ceremonies, the right to traditional healing, you know, the right to declare public health emergencies, or to decide what's best with, you know, your community. The same thing applies to research in tribal public health, you know, data modernization. We're looking at electronic health records and how tribes may fit into the health information exchange. So that right to decide how that data, that information is used, who it's used with, how it's shared, who speaks for it. And some of that even applies to the work that we're doing here in, you know, with Sand Creek, and who owns that information? Who owns those stories? You know, and there's outside entities that are partners with us, like the National Park Service, like the Sand Creek Foundation, that are working with us. And, you know, those conversations are important to have the groundwork. You know, they and the Methodist Church that we work with, now because Shivington and Governor Evans were Methodists, the United Methodist Church has taken great steps to account for, be accountable, and take ownership and responsibility for the role that they played in that massacre. So they've been very respectful about ensuring that our tribal voices are heard and that the proper consents and permissions are obtained before this information gets out there. So we do stand as tribal reps. There's myself, that I represent the Cheyenne and Arapaho tribes here in Oklahoma. Otto Braided Hair, who represents the Northern Cheyenne up in Montana, and Gail Ridgely, who represents the Northern Arapaho in Wyoming. So collectively, we represent, you know, our tribal descendants, our Sand Creek descendants who were present at Sand Creek.
And this is, to keep on this thread, this year, if I'm not mistaken, is it the 50th anniversary of the Indian, is it Self-Determination Act?
ISDEA 93638. Yes.
Yes. Okay. So how does that relate to the work that you're doing now? And the reason I bring it up is just for context too, for listeners, Work is Third is about work not being our life. But one of the themes that comes up is when your work is your passion versus when you work to support your passion. And what you are doing as someone who is Cheyenne and Arapaho is also, it's very much a part of who you are as a human being, of course, but also it is part of the work that you do, like your paid work. So maybe, you know, tell us a little bit more about how those two things blend for you and where sometimes you may draw the line because you want to focus your energy on the work that you're doing in your community and the work that you're doing on the Sand Creek Massacre Memorial versus the work that you do in data modernization.
Yeah, well, sometimes when Native people leave the reservation, leave their tribe and go off and get educated, a lot of times they stay in that field and they don't come back and contribute back. You know, it's a lot of our people, their prayers were that they would go get educated and come back and help their people, help lift their people up. And I actually did get some flack when I initially came back and worked with my tribe. I was told, you know, you're kind of like those people out there, you know, those white people, you know, kind of that Western mentality. And I would say that bothered me. I grew up in a pretty traditional household, and sometimes people have to go. They have to make uncomfortable choices, but I did come back and it made me want to become more involved. Like I mentioned, my eyes were open to the landscape of the broader picture and some of the lessons. And when you have the ability to go and visit tribes across the country and see the work that they're doing, and then you come back and you see your community and the potential that's there, not what they're not doing, but it's like, what's the potential here? You know, what ingredients do we need? What things do we need to put in place in order to, you know, have this evolution? Like I've seen other tribes, we've seen Cherokee Nation. You know, when you think back to the late 70s and 80s, when Wilma Mankiller became governor or became the tribal chief, they had this movement they called Gadugi, and it was kind of a community-led effort, grassroots, and it was just this empowerment. And you look at where they are now, you know, some of our traditional tribes cannot knock the Cherokees because they're doing great things with, you know, language and cultural preservation and economic development. You know, they are just rocking and rolling. And same thing with Chickasaw Nation, they're doing really great things. Their motto, their mantra was, you take care of the health of their people, they're going to thrive. So you see that happening through their medical services, their clinics, their prevention programs. I've seen absentees, Osage Nation, where young people start coming back and contributing, and there's like a movement. So I'm hoping to plant those seeds in our community.
I think this is something that I am really passionate about too. I grew up in a rural community, and I think some of the concerns are similar, which is if you go away to college, do you move back to that community that you grew up in? Or do you stay where you are? And then what does it mean to go back, and how do you contribute? But it sounds like you are able to leverage your training, your education, and the work that you've done in public health also to help advance public health for your people. And I think this is where we can tie the data in, because I think a lot of people may not realize that not all tribes have their own public health systems. And data is an important part of that, because data about people's health is what tells us where do we need to invest our resources to make sure people are healthy so that our communities can thrive. And that one of the challenges is who owns data for, about Indigenous people, and then what do they do with that data? And do they do it in partnership? Do they do it with rather than for? So tell me a little bit more about that aspect, like of the tribal public health work, and as a tribal public health advisor, what you see and do.
I recently wrote another article for our tribal newspaper, and it was kind of a call to action in relation to the 50 years of ISDE. You know, we're still operating at the same level back in 1976. IHS is still taking care of our clinical needs, and we've managed to contract some of our prevention programs, but we have a long way to go compared to how some tribes have evolved. So I hoped that article would prompt some of our elected leaders to kind of think about what we're doing, how we go about it. I feel like the legal and governance approach is paramount, because that's your standing. That's your sovereignty, you know? So when you establish that, you empower your government, your health departments to have that standing, the tribal public health authority status to decide those important decisions, how that engages with IHS, or if you're going to have your own electronic health system with traditional healing, traditional medicine, the taxonomies that go with that and the descriptors that go in that electronic health record, those kinds of information, that knowledge needs to be protected. Dominant population has no business knowing where our sacred sites are, other than that they need to have respect for them and don't ask unless they're given permission. I have some strong feelings about that, but even our ceremonies, what we do with that healing, it's not something to be studied and dissected and put out there. With my dad being so connected, my father was a military. He was in the Korean War. He was a veteran, and he was very involved in the community with his work through the Collar Guard, representing our tribe. He was involved with the First American Museum, the ground blessing that they had here in Oklahoma. He was in the National Museum of the American Indian, the grand parade that they had when they opened, Kansas City Chiefs, Oklahoma City Thunder. You know, he's had some really great things, but his also community work that he would do. One thing I mentioned, I don't live with my tribe in the service area. I live in Norman. But one lesson that I learned from my dad is your community, your people, and taking care of who you're around, regardless if you're with your people or in the urban area, you know, you still have Native people. And I feel like it's, you know, like him, he lived up in Utah. He got captured by a Ute woman and lived up there for about maybe 15 or 20 years. But he was very involved with the health programs up there and the community and with their traditions. He cared about his community. So that was kind of my involvement here in Norman. We've got Native people here that need representing, that need a voice. That was part of my getting involved with the city of Norman and their Human Rights Commission, is to try to be that voice for those that don't have one and advocate. You know, it was all about advocacy. A year ago, we had a mayor that didn't feel that the Native American Heritage Month or Columbus Day recognition, Sovereignty Day, was important. You know, so those things kind of got left behind, got lost. So it kind of showed to me that that's more of a reason why we need to advocate and make sure that our voices are heard. You know, especially now with this administration reinstating Columbus Day, and the truth be told, Columbus caused a lot of atrocities. Right. So that truth needs to be spoken and acknowledged and not forgotten. You know?
I appreciate that you say that, because I struggle sometimes with people who do say, well, we shouldn't have changed it from Columbus Day, and who I also think don't even understand what it means to recognize Indigenous Peoples Day, or don't even understand what it means to recognize our history and the history of the oppression of people. It's like we talk about the good things, but we don't talk about these atrocities that were committed sometimes and these ways in which people were oppressed. But it is an important part of healing, as you were saying, that we do that. And especially, I think, sharing the stories of the people who experienced it, but also you as a descendant and the people who are descendants of these acts, you still have that as part of your history and part of your legacy. And as you mentioned, that informs your resiliency going forward. Like, you're able to give back, you're able to build, in that what you're doing right now with the Sand Creek Massacre Memorial is part of healing. I don't know if you want to talk more about that and the importance of recognizing our history to healing.
You know, that's a really, really important part. Being in that area, it was explained to me that our people, they died very horrible deaths, very unexpected. And in our traditional teachings, our views of that kind of death, your spirit's unsettled and it doesn't travel on home like it should along that Milky Way. They go off to a place called the Hanged Road. And it's kind of like purgatory, you know, their spirits are not at rest. So there's ceremonies that go with our people, any culture, there's ceremonies that are for healing, are for commemorating, are for rites of passage, you know, and those are important in both a community way, a personal way, even with families that are needing that healing. And, you know, those ceremonies, you have to protect the integrity of them, the integrity and how they operate and what they're for. And that's done through the protocol and procedure of how those things are conducted. So, myself, I'm a member of our Cheyenne Council of 44, which was our traditional, which is our traditional leadership for our Cheyenne people. That in essence means I'm a Cheyenne chief, and it's something that I don't take lightly. I'm also what you would consider a ceremonial person, meaning I take care of, you know, our ceremonies. I help take care of our annual renewal ceremonies. And sometimes when we lose a loved one, when they go home, there's ceremony that goes with them transitioning on their spirit. And then there's also ceremony that goes with taking care of that family when they go into mourning. So there's protocols and procedures that go with that. And it also involves healing too. You know, sometimes we carry that grief, we pick up things out there in the environment, and that kind of takes a burden on our spiritual health, which can manifest to our spirit, our physical health and mental. So, you know, having those ceremonies to help take care of that person holistically, or the community, or your people. So when we went out there this past weekend for Sand Creek to commemorate that, it involved taking my ceremonial pipe out and praying and thinking about our people. But it's not just also our people. It's also the families, the descendants of those soldiers that helped commit those atrocities. Those families need healing too. They're looking for forgiveness. So being able to kind of help facilitate that transition for a group of people, it's important. As a chief, you make sure that everybody's taken care of. Your people come first. So a lot of times when we have gatherings, we have food, we eat, you know, out of respect of my role, I make sure that everybody goes first, that they're fed and that they're taken care of before I'm taken care of. That's protocol. That goes with keeping that integrity of that position that we have as chiefs. You know, our chiefs were, like I said, our leadership, our traditional leadership. We've got societies like Dog Soldiers, Kit Fox, Bowstring, and Elk that help support the chiefs. The chiefs made the policy, and the other societies are the ones that carried it out and enforced it. So traditional law, society law, and how that fits into this structure, it all fits together on how it supports that healing. If things were just anyway and not strictly adhered to, there wouldn't be that consistency. You know, whenever I come back to our annual renewal ceremonies in the summer, and you step into that sacred space, that teepee or that lodge, and you smell those smells, those songs that are being sang, it feels like you never left. It's just a really good feeling in your heart.
I really appreciate that. And I think about those like cultural practices around recognizing and honoring our ancestors and our traditions and the people who, you know, the people who have come before us. And I think that probably in kind of dominant culture, you know, that people are not being as intentional about honoring the past and honoring their ancestors. I was thinking about this, like if you lose a loved one, my father passed away in 2010. We don't do an annual remembrance of him, even though we remember his birthday or we remember my parents' anniversary or things like that. But I think this is bigger than that. It's not just about remembering the individual, but also about recognizing your people, right? Your community, all the people who came before you. And I wonder if that's something that as a society, that having that into reintegrated into how we approach healing and connection, is something that is we need to do, right? If we need to bring that back into the way that we practice to be very much more intentional about recognizing those rites of passage, as you were saying.
Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree. I think human culture, human, just basic human need, we need those transitions to kind of help us cope, whether it's birth or that, you know, in the Navajo religion, the Diné religion or Diné way, that first laugh, there's a ceremony with that or marriage, birth phase, being 16, turning of age to get your driver's license. Think about that rite of passage. Yeah, there's ceremony that goes with that. And just when you break down the whole thing of what ceremony is, what rites of passage, there's a thing. Liminality, liminal state. Have you heard of that? Where the way that I want to kind of explain it, because I feel like a lot of this is relevant, you know, with healing. You think of somebody thinking about wanting to go into a program, a JD program, perhaps a legal program. So they make a decision, they take that test and they get accepted. Before, they're just an ordinary human being. They got their bachelor's degrees and they apply to the law program and they get accepted. And all at once, they become in this liminal state. They're not there. They're not here, but they're just kind of in that middle, that transitory. And that transitory means that they're getting instruction, they're being taught, they're being told how to be once they do get out. And then there's a ceremony, there's a graduation, or even passing the bar. And once you pass that bar, then you have a whole different set of instructions and responsibilities that you have to keep, you know? And that liminal state, that's applicable to those of us that maybe are ceremonial. And when you make a vow for somebody's health or to have a better life, while you're going through that ceremony, you're in this liminal state. And then once you complete that ceremony and you come out the other side, you have this other set of responsibilities. The whole purpose of those is you don't ever make those vows for yourself on behalf of yourself. You do it for somebody else that is in need of prayer, or maybe they're sick. So you make the sacrifice to go without comforts, sleep, food, water, daily comforts, and you sacrifice. You're sacrificing yourself for that. And you know, when you come back to this world, once you complete that ceremony and you come back to this world, there's a process to bring you back. Your spirit and your physical and mental self as well. Right. So I think sometimes we forget about those as we get going through technology, and maybe we start to celebrate these technological things telling you when to check your social media. Yes.
Yeah.
You know, so
that's what I was thinking, right? It's such a distraction. Today's modern technology in modern society is such a distraction from the things that root and ground us. Part of why I started this podcast is because I wanted to have conversations like this, where we talk about creating space for healing, creating space for joy and celebration, creating space for connection with our community, because those are the things that ground us, root us, and sustain us. We're not paying attention to it when we're on our phones, when we're constantly looking for the next shiny thing.
Absolutely. It's got its good pros and cons. I used my technology this weekend to record a song that I heard somebody singing so that I could learn that. Makes it convenient. Hey, I can go back and check the recording. I can rewind it. We didn't have that luxury. You know, you're sitting in a ceremony and you can't say, hey, wait a minute, I missed that part. Back up, you know. It's not like that. So we got to find balance with not just our mental, physical, and spiritual health, but with technology too. Artificial yes. intelligence, infrastructure, how that technology plays a role in our lives, you know, whether it's our tribe or, you know, our health record and how that's protected. I think kind of like your digital footprint that you may have, you know, you think that in the context of your spirit and how important that is, and you take care of it, your digital footprint, you need to make sure that you're protected. There's things that you have to do, whether it's around your financial security, your individual identity, or even your family. So you got to take measures to protect your information. So that same thing goes with taking care of yourself, your spirit, making sure that you get enough sleep, you're nourished, you know, you're eating a good balance, you're drinking water, and stress, you know, learning to deal with it and manage it. My wife, I have to give her a lot of credit for being married to me for 18 years, but I don't know that I would be doing half the things that I do now, or I would be where I'm at, were it not for her support. She didn't do it for me, but she supported me in my endeavors to kind of go along with my wild ideas. But those things, they add to your experience. And my wife, in full disclosure, she's not Cheyenne. My wife is Italian and she's from Rhode Island. We have a really, really good relationship and marriage that it's supportive. And I'm grateful. Men, make sure that you give your wives, your counterpart, a lot of credit for supporting you, because without women, menfolk, we wouldn't be here. You know, men cannot bring life into this world. Women, you are sacred. Your ability to bring life into this world, and you are able to talk to the Creator, have a direct connection with Him. You know, so when you pray, your prayers go straight to Mahel, the Creator. When we pray, we have to invoke these spirits, these cardinal directions, and we have to ask them to take our prayers up to the Creator. That's kind of how our Cheyenne belief is. We give women a lot of credit for the work and the sacrifice that they do. When we have our ceremonies up in that teepee, it's our women that are at the camp that take care of it. They take care of our guests, visitors. They make sure that we're nourished by sending food. And it's hot at that camp. It's tough cooking over an open flame in the summertime. Sometimes the wind, the dust, the rain. But our women are committed. And they're strong, and we wouldn't be here without them. So thank you, ladies, for everything that you do for us men.
I appreciate so much here everything that you were saying, just because it's so beautiful to hear all the things, right? We're recognizing your partner in life, recognizing the power of women bringing life into the world. The Cheyenne people are matriarchal historically, right?
We follow our father's side of the way. Okay. Our Cheyenne names are handed down through our father's side of the family. Our maternal side, those are still very important. Okay. But ceremonially, traditionally, we followed our father's side. I got to spend a lot of time with my dad, you know, just his service to community, his people. He loved his people, and he was kind of like servant leadership. And I learned how to be through him. He was raised by his grandfather named Black Wolf. Black Wolf was born in 1854 and died in 1942. My dad, he was 7 when Black Wolf passed. And then my dad got sent to an Indian boarding school, Concho Indian Boarding School, from the age of 7 until he was about 17 years old. And he started seeing his classmates start to enlist to go to Korea. It was kind of a get out of boarding school. So my dad, at the age of 17, his mom signed for him and he joined the Marines. And by the time my dad was maybe 19, he was over in Japan on the other side of the world. And he did 2 tours during Korea and came back. He had an honorable discharge, came back and met my mom. They started a family. They were both part of the Indian relocation program back in the early 60s. They went to California. My dad got a welding trade out of San Francisco, California. And after he finished that, he got a decent job. They were starting to settle in. And my mother got homesick and she felt very strong that they wanted their children to know their people, know their Cheyenne people, and grow up and you know, help carry on. So they came back to Oklahoma and started having kids. They settled in Western Oklahoma, our home place where my mom grew up at, and that's where I grew up. I was born at the Clinton Indian Hospital and it's no longer in existence. But my mom went home in 1984, walked on, and then my dad, he passed away in 2020. But, you know, the sacrifices that they made, the struggles that they had, the historical trauma, my mom, my dad, you know, this historical trauma is still very much present. When they were young, even today, I still feel that historical trauma, that just a range of emotions, but how you deal with it. And I feel like I'm thankful that they made that sacrifice to come back to Oklahoma and that we could be involved. You know, my dad exposed me to Christianity, Baptist out in Western Oklahoma. There were Mennonites. I had classmates that were Mennonites. We went to Bible school in the summertime. I had a grandpa that was a Jehovah's Witness that would come over often. And we also had Native American church. My dad would, we would go to Mexico, pick peyote, pick medicine, bring it back. And, you know, they'd have Native American church meetings at our house, our home. My dad would put a teepee up. So being exposed to those ceremonies, sweat lodge, our Cheyenne ceremonies, renewal ceremonies. So I remember asking my dad, why do we go to all these different ceremonies, these different ways? And I was probably about 10, and he smiled and he told me, he said, one day, he said, you're going to make a choice. You're going to choose which way to follow. And he said, I want you to know all of them before you make that decision. So he supported me, and I ended up taking our traditional way of life and, you know, embracing that. It's a little bit hard being remote, being in Norman, and my people live out in Western Oklahoma, but I do feel like whether you're in an urban environment or a rural environment, you know, as long as you embrace your culture and your traditions, you're not separated from them. I still, you know, put my teepee up in my yard, and I have an industrial sewing machine that I purchased back during the first Trump period when he gave out that money. And I took that money and I bought a Juki. It was a double needle industrial sewing machine. Didn't know how to sew, but I thought, oh, wow, it'd be a cool idea to learn how to make teepees. So I hired somebody. He taught me how to use it. And I've been sewing with it. I've made,
you know, make some teepees?
I have the ability to make teepees, yes. And I
did not know that about you.
Yeah. So I have that, and that keeps you connected, you know, with your culture. And you know, I hope to grow that one day. I do have a name. It's called Bear Lodge Teepees. And, you know, I feel like there'll be some potential. I would be the only Cheyenne, you know, the only company that would make authentic Cheyenne teepees made by a real Cheyenne. So, the other thing, you know, my dad was a welder. So, you know, just before he passed, I really wanted a welder. So I bought me a Lincoln portable arc welder, and I invited him over to come show it to him just before he passed. And he took one look at it and his eyes about popped out of his head. He was like, this is too much welder for you. He said, let me take it off your hands. So he offered to take it, but I was like, no. How about we co-own it? So the last photo my wife took of me and my dad, it's both of us with our welding hoods on, and we're leaning over this welding arc, looking into it. And it's a really cool picture. So
that's amazing.
It's good to have something portable like that. And having a sewing machine, you know, sometimes tents, teepees, box tents need repairing. So I really embrace our culture. So I don't feel separated from my people. And I also try to give back as often as I can. I serve on my tribe's tribal health board. We have monthly meetings. So staying connected and doing things to kind of help build the community up. I'm working on trying to introduce the idea of a tribal public health authority. I also serve on the I'm a Cheyenne representative for the NAGPRA, Native American Grave and Repatriation Act. So a lot. Yeah. Our chief's council. Since Sand Creek happened, because that was the chief's camp, we have this council of 44. So there were 44 chiefs, Cheyenne chiefs total. There are 10 bands of Cheyenne. From each van came 4 chiefs, and then there were 4 additional chiefs that were appointed, making the Cheyenne Council of 44. And when Sand Creek happened, there were several chiefs that got killed. And since then, our Cheyenne Chiefs Council has not been restored. So we're working on meeting with our Northern Cheyenne and our Southern Cheyenne chiefs to have dialogue to talk about restoring that chief's council again. We are of the mind and of the belief that if we restore that chief's council, that it will help towards the healing of our people.
Yeah, you've mentioned this inclusive representation of leaders in the Council of Chiefs. You also talked about, with the memorial, including the descendants and survivors of the soldiers, in addition to the Cheyenne and Arapaho people. And that really strikes me because that is where healing occurs, where we do have those connections with other people, where we recognize all of the people who are affected in the different ways that they're affected, and try to have open and honest conversations about that, but also to find a path forward together.
These conversations are important, and I'm just so thankful that they're, you know, this work brings out the best in people. And it's good to see those efforts come together after so many years of divisiveness and obstacles. It took several attempts. It wasn't just an easy thing to step into. And I know that our previous chiefs that had initiated this work, notably Laird Kometseva, that kind of kicked everything off. He was one of those old men chiefs that, you know, he was strict, he was disciplined, and he drove the process. But there's been many, many people, actors, players along the way that are allies of our efforts for the Sand Creek Memorial. I'm just really, really thankful. Like I said, it brings out the best in many people. There's plenty of opportunities for prayer, for healing, you know, and just forgiveness.
I am curious because we've talked a lot about how important ceremony is and embracing your traditions and history are to you personally. Are there other things that you also do to take care of yourself and to heal yourself and be well?
Well, I will say this. It's important that we recognize some of those signals and we pay attention to what's going on with us. When I went to Sand Creek this past weekend, I didn't know that I would be so heavily impacted, you know, by what went on, by being in that space, being out there at the grounds and at the massacre site at dawn. When that attack happened and feeling that cold, just the wind blowing and the absolute cold. And it is so desolate out there. And just kind of being in that space, it invokes, you know, through epigenetics or intergenerational trauma, it invokes a lot of feeling. And being in prayer, it helps get you through those difficult times and having fellowship with other people who are descendants that are walking with you, that understand that journey, that take it with a lot of seriousness too, you know. So that protocol and procedure are important. But picking up, getting in the car and traveling to Denver that evening and, you know, being a speaker at the Sand Creek Vigil that evening at the Denver Public Library. And this year was the largest crowd that they have received. Usually they have around 100 people. I think they said it was around 140 people or 170 that showed up this year. But speaking about the healing, what we're talking about here, or the atrocities that happened, and it's just the collective energy that as a traditional healer, you take on a lot of that energy and you take on that burden and people needing that healing. People, the whole purpose of smudging people, or what they call brushing them off, is to take that negative energy that maybe they were carrying or that they picked up from their environment and taking it away for them and disposing of it. But then again, there's also that part about self-care. So as a healer, how do you get rid of that burden? How do you cleanse yourself and be strong enough for others, you know? Or how do you teach others to do that? So it's working with other people that are of that like mind or that carry that same responsibility. And it's being honest and open about how you feel so that they understand. Maybe they're feeling the same way and just don't know how to verbalize it, you know? But being around our people, being around myself getting brushed off or smudged by other ceremonial people, that helps, or having others, asking others to pray for you, asking for help that way. And even the gift of nourishment, people bringing you a plate of food or a meal and nourishing you physically, that goes a long way. Or even just sitting down and praying with you. I think connection with my tribal people, whether they're ceremonial or not, just that connection through technology here, Zoom, Google Meets is great, because you kind of have that ability to instantly connect. It's not necessarily sitting there with them, but it helps. It helps until, you know, you do meet them in person.
I totally agree that it's nice that we can keep those connections even virtually. You know, I don't live near my family, and so technology allows us to be connected when we might not otherwise be. So what I would like to do is, we're talking about healing and we're talking about the ways that we take care of ourselves. I would love to ask you the four questions that I ask every guest. And I'm curious, based on the direction of our conversation today, how you will answer them. Are you ready for the four questions?
Drum roll, let's go.
Okay. Well, the first question is, what is something that it is easy for you to say yes to?
That's easy to say yes to. Bread pudding that my wife makes. She makes the best bread pudding.
So. That sounds incredible.
Yes. This time of the year? Absolutely.
I made my first bread pudding this last week. I made a pumpkin pie bread pudding.
Ooh. I'll have to tell her about that. Maybe you'll have to share the recipe with her.
I'd be glad to. And if hers is amazing, I would love to swap recipes.
All right.
Okay. Absolutely. So the second question then is, what is something that it is hard for you to say no to?
You know, when you take on a ceremonial role with your people, or you're seated as a traditional leader, a chief, that word no gets taken out of your vocabulary. So when people come to you and they need help, they're asking for help. No, nimamotos, have pity on me. You know, you have to help them. There's a lot of protocol procedure that goes with this role, this position. If somebody says, hey, I like the shirt you're wearing, or I like that, you know, you're obligated to give it to them. So I had a shirt on over the weekend at the vigil that, you know, a little bit of an activism, but it said to resist. It had an Indian chief on there and it talked about resist. And there was a community member that came up that said, yeah, I like that shirt. So I had to take it off and give it to them. So sometimes it's hard, because they are objects. There are things that you cherish, but you know, whenever you're unselfish about it, there's a part of you that kind of grows from that, learns to grow, you know, so that you're not holding on to material things. If it's going to make somebody else happy or benefit them, then that should be the blessing.
Last night, I was asking people, like, what boundary are you setting for the holiday season? And several people talked about saying no to more stuff and just being able to gift that to other people who might be in need if they no longer need it.
Yeah. It's charity. You know, whenever you pray, when we pray for people, you pray for good health, long life, and charity, you know. And that ability to give of yourself, it's love for your people, love for your people.
The next question is, when it comes to the ways that you take care of yourself, set boundaries, find joy, live well, what do you do really well?
Reflect, I listen, I acknowledge, and I affirm. I like to empower people. I like to see people empowered, and from our interactions, I like to see them benefit from that. So just leaving your people in a better place than you found them. That's what my dad tells me. He says, you never know when it's the creator testing to see how you are, how you act.
And what were the four words you said? It was reflect, affirm, acknowledge, listen.
Listen.
And empower. So then the flip side of that question is there any place where you still struggle or you still find challenges? When you think about the ways that you take care of yourself or your well-being.
Need to drink more water. I need to eat more same. Vegetables.
Also same.
Yes. And, you know, I need to be better to myself. I need more self-care. you know, because you give so much of yourself. When I came back from Denver this past weekend, I got back to Oklahoma, and for about a day yesterday, I just needed to completely shut down. I needed to just reset, you know, turn my phone off, didn't check my emails. My wife was at school, so it was a good time for me to just leave the TV off, leave the technology off. And it was good to go outside and be in nature, be around the trees, be on the earth, touch that earth, even though it was cold. But you still need those elements that ground you. I think by nature, we need those things. We need that to recharge. My dogs, nothing but love. You know, they accept you as you are. And all they want is affirmation that, you know, you're going to give them a treat, give them their next meal. It was really good to do that and just have a good sit down conversation with my wife and kind of debrief and thank her, you know, for taking care of my home and being here and loving me. I couldn't do the work that I do without her.
I appreciate what you say, because it's a really great reminder that we often are able to make it through things that are challenging for us because we have the support and love of other people in our life. And it's also really important to make that space to rest, to take care of yourself, to recharge your battery, especially when we experience heavy things, as you were saying this weekend was for you, that we don't have to jump right back into work. We don't have to jump right back into our role as a caregiver or as a partner or whatever role that might be, that you can take that time and need to take that time to recharge yourself.
Yeah. Self-care is paramount, especially with the world that we live in now. Learning to laugh both at yourself and sometimes when life throws challenges to you, learning to thank the creator for his humor.
I appreciate that for sure. Yeah. Having laughter, indulging in laughter, especially at yourself, being able to do that is such a gift.
Yes, 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 yes.
So, Chris, we've been talking for a while, but as we wrap up the conversation, I'm wondering if there's anything, any thought that you would like to leave guests with, either as a reflection on this conversation or something that is on your heart to share.
Part of my self-determination and my sovereignty, and also with being a traditional leader, having that sovereignty to speak openly and candidly about what you're doing in your work, being your own, you know, being autonomous. That was part of my reasoning for developing my own LLC. I've got a webpage. It is tallbearllc.com. And just trying to be humble about it as well. I heard a really great quote when I was up in Billings at Rocky Mountain Tribal Leaders annual conference a couple of years ago. There was a lady, she was Blackfeet Crow, and she was a guest speaker, a keynote speaker. Her name was Dr. Iris Pretty Paint, heavy runner. And one of the comments that she said was, you can't lead where you haven't been. You can't lead where you haven't been. We're not hang around the Ford Indians, you know, we're very resilient. We embrace the future and we have to be able to thrive and demonstrate that resiliency in the 21st century. Some of my conversations are about how to be a chief, how to be a traditional chief in the 21st century with artificial intelligence and technology. You know, how do we navigate that? How do we stay true to who we are as traditional leaders, but yet lead our people into this evolution, not being dependent, you know, being sovereign, having that self-determination. We have beautiful things, traditional healing, traditional medicine, and we talk about incorporating those into our holistic healing and those kinds of things. Now we're best suited when tribes take that initiative and that leadership role.
Chris, I'm very excited for your entrepreneurial journey and to see what you do with your company, and really have appreciated this conversation today. It's just been so rich. And honestly, I'm so glad that you were willing to come on here, because when every time I've talked to you in person or even virtually, I just always appreciate the energy and the thoughtfulness you bring to the conversation. So really grateful that you were willing to be a guest today.
Thank you. I look forward to seeing you again. And it's good to see you doing great things here. I like your podcast.
Well, thank you so much. And hopefully we'll get some updates from you too about how things are going, and the podcast will stay connected with you.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
If this conversation resonated with you, I invite you to reflect on your own relationship to history, community, and leadership. What does healing look like where you stand? If you found value here, share this episode, leave a review, and join us in the Joyful Rebellion, where we practice leadership that honors both people and performance. And thanks so much, Chris, for such an insightful conversation. Work is important, but it's not the whole story of who you are. Until next time, remember, work is third.